This is day six of this November 2018 7-day session. And we'll take up a koan today. This is from the Book of Serenity, a collection of koans, sometimes translated as the Book of Equanimity, both really beautiful words. And it's a Japanese word is the Shoyuroku. The title is the Shoyuroku. This is number 20. It's called Dizang's Most Intimate. It's fairly short. Dizang asked Fa Yen, "Where are you going?" Fa Yen said, "I am wandering on pilgrimage." Dizang said, "What are you on pilgrimage for?" Fa Yen said, "I don't know." Dizang said, "Not knowing is the most intimate." And at that, Fa Yen was suddenly enlightened. I do have biographical material on these two guys. Dizang's sometimes listed as under the name Luohan, but we're going to use Dizang. His dates are Tang Dynasty, 9th to 10th centuries. He's a disciple of Xuanzha, in Japanese known as Gensha. The old records say that from early childhood on, he could speak very well and would not eat meat. I've heard of children in our Sangha who take that position. They just don't want to eat meat. But then I think it's changes as they get older. Their friends are eating meat and they don't want to be different. It seems only natural that a child would recoil from eating animal flesh, but I guess it would be more common, though. At first, he involved himself in the Vinaya school, the school of monastic rules and regulations. A very big sect of Tang Dynasty China, even though it's all but absent now, at least in the West. But he later declared that just guarding against breaking the vows and adhering to the precepts did not equal true renunciation. So then he set off to explore the teachings of Chan. Certainly, he's right that just following the precepts is not the real renunciation. The ultimate renunciation, the summit of renunciation, is renouncing one's thoughts, because it's the hardest thing to renounce. We are so addicted to our thoughts. Suppose you could include that under the fifth precept. Fifth precept is not to indulge in alcohol or drugs, but to keep the mind clear. It is something addictive about thoughts. So he went off to look into the Zen school. He first trained under the famous Shui Feng, but was unsuccessful at penetrating the way. These are the words from the records themselves. The translation from the Chinese records. He was unsuccessful at penetrating the way. But Xuefeng's disciple, Xuanzha, is said to have brought Dizang to full awakening. The records indicate that when the following exchange between teacher and student occurred, all of Dizang's doubts were erased. Here's the exchange. Xuanzha questioned Dizang, saying, "In the three realms there is only mind. How do you understand this?" Dizang pointed to a chair and said, "What does the master call that?" Xuanzha said, "A chair." Dizang said, "Then the master can't say that in three worlds there is only mind." Xuanzha said, "I say that it is made from bamboo and wood. What do you say it's made from?" Dizang said, "I also say it's made from bamboo and wood." Xuanzha said, "I've searched across the great earth for a person who understands the Buddha Dharma, but I haven't found one." So they weren't speaking the same language. They weren't using terms the same way. Xuanzha, we can call something by its conventional name, chair, cushion, tree. Doesn't mean it's not this one mind that embraces all things. Xuanzha gave him a second chance. "I say it's made from bamboo and wood." Dizang said, "Yes, it's made from bamboo and wood." And then Xuanzha, it's an unusual dialogue that is recorded as the awakening of Dizang. Doesn't say anything in there about awakening, and Xuanzha doesn't sound thrilled with Dizang's answers. In some anecdotes here, Dizang once entered the monastic hall and addressed the monks, saying, "If you want to come face to face with the essential mystery of our order, here it is. There's no other special thing. If it is something else, then bring it forth and let's see it. If you can't show it, then forget about it." If you want to come face to face with the essential mystery of our order, here it is. Just this. Where else could it be? What else could it be? And then he's, it's quite a long passage here where he's, rebuking the use of these abstract terms like the essential vehicle, teaching vehicle, which apparently the monks were tossing around without really understanding it. You come here, he says, you come here and use words like tranquility, reality, perfection, or constancy. What is this that you call tranquil or real? What is it that's perfect or constant? All that you're remembering and holding on to is just sounds and forms. if it weren't all sounds and forms, names and words, then how would you remember them or figure them out? The wind blows and the pine makes a sound. A frog or a duck makes a sound. Why don't you go and listen to those things and figure them out? If everywhere there are meaningful sounds and forms, then how much meaning can be ascribed to this old monk? There's no doubt about it. Sounds and forms assault us every moment. Do you directly face them or not? If you face them directly, then your diamond, solid concept of self will melt away. To directly face them is to experience them directly, as a direct experience, a naked, pure experience with no thoughts clinging to them, or associations, memories, just the pure sound. It's a very pure state to just hear the sound, just the sound. Just the geese, just the train, just the cough on the other side of the zendo. A monk asked, "What is Dizan's single phrase?" He's asking for his teaching. Dizan said, "If I tell you, it will turn into two phrases." A monk asked, "What is Dizang's house style?" Or meaning style of teaching or training. "What is Dizang's house style?" Dizang said, "I can't tell you." The monk said, "Why not?" Dizang said, "Because it's my house style." A fish doesn't know it's in water. Here's another passage where Dizang takes issue with monks throwing around words out of formality. When he saw a monk approaching, he held up his whisk and said, "Do you understand?" The monk said, "Thank you for your compassionate instruction, master." Dizang said, "You see me raise the whisk and you say I'm instructing you. When you see the mountains and rivers each day, do they not instruct you?" Another time, Dizang saw a monk approaching and held up his whisk, same thing. The monk shouted in praise and bowed. Dizang said, "When you saw me raise the whisk, you bowed and shouted. Why is it that when someone holds up a broom, you don't shout in praise?" We can't have that during the work period. Another time, Dizang asked a monk, "Where do you come from?" The monk said, "From Zhuzhou." Dizang said, "What did you bring with you?" It's a loaded question. The monk said, "I didn't bring anything with me." Dizang said, "Why are you deceiving people?" The monk remained silent. And then, that's Dizang, and then we have a few for Fayin. There was actually a whole school, a whole lineage named the Fayen school. His Japanese name is Hogen. His dates, well, of course, about the same. He was still in the same. He's in the same story here, the same koan. He was Dizong's disciple. When he was 7, he entered a Zen monastery. These monasteries were huge complexes that often would include schools for these young monks, whose parents would bring them. Sometimes the parents would be steeped in such poverty that they thought their best bet for the child would be to take him to the monastery, where they would be well educated, I suppose. Based on what it says here, he was well educated and erudite as a young man. He studied the Confucian classics, and he received full ordination at the age of 20. He too began under the Vinaya school, and then he went and studied with a Zen master. And while he was on pilgrimage with some other monks, he and his friends were sidetracked by a snowstorm and forced to stay at the Dizong monastery. The man we're calling Dizong would have been taken his name from the monastery. And they were forced to stay at the Dizong monastery. Dizong served as abbot there. And this is from an old record called The Transmission of the Lamp. Oh, that's this koan today. Where are you going on a pilgrimage, and why are you? I don't know, and so forth. But there's a different account of Fayen's encounter with Dizong and his subsequent awakening. When the snow was gone, the three monks bade farewell and started to depart. Dizong accompanied them to the gate and asked, "I've heard you say several times that the three realms are only mind, and the myriad dharmas are only consciousness." So just a little bit of explanation. The three realms, they could mean past, present, and future, but more often the three realms refer to the world of form, the desire, the world of form without desire, and the world of formlessness. Not that you have to remember that, but those are the three. It's just meant to signify all things, everything conceivable. And the same with the myriad dharmas. Dharmas, when it's plural and small d, means things, phenomena. So everything, everywhere are only mind, only consciousness. And then he's quoting them. We would have overheard them talking about what they had read. And then he pointed to a rock lying on the ground by the gate where they were about to leave, and he said, "So, do you say that this rock is inside or outside of mind?" Fayen stood up and said, "Inside." Dizong said, "How can a pilgrim carry such a rock in his mind while on pilgrimage?" Fayen was dumbfounded and couldn't answer. Right there, he set his luggage down at Dizong's feet and asked him for the truth. Then each day for the next month or so, Fayen spoke about the way, the Dharma, with Dizong and demonstrated his understanding as such as he could. Dizong would always say, "The Buddha Dharma isn't like that." Finally, Fayen said, "I've run out of words and ideas." Dizong said, he saw an opening there, "If you want to talk about the Buddha Dharma, everything you see embodies it." And at these words, Fayen experienced great enlightenment. So were these two different enlightenment experiences, or just two different stories, competing stories? And in this second story, like the first, the important thing was that Fayen's state of mind. I've run out of words and ideas. Oh, that's promising. And Dizong saw his opportunity and just made a simple statement. But now, Fayen really took it in because his mind was empty. The statement is one that surely Fayen would have heard, read, or somewhere. If you want to talk about Buddha Dharma, everything you see embodies it. Now, Fayen came to awakening. And at that, then, Fayen became the Dharma heir under Dizong. He went on to establish one of the five recognized schools of Chan. He became renowned as a teacher, and his students were said to have numbered up to 1,000. Here's a charming story. Fayen was traveling, and he arrived at a place where the provincial governor invited him to become abbot of the local monastery. And he must have accepted because there was this dedication scheduled. But on dedication day, Fayen remained sitting in the tea hall and did not leave it. A monk said to him, "Monks from everywhere are now crowded around the master's Dharma seat waiting for you to speak." Fayen said, "In that case, the monks are practicing with a genuine worthy." After a while, Fayen did take the seat. A monk said, "The assembly has gathered. We ask the master to expound the Dharma." Fayen said, "You've all been standing here too long." Then he said, "Since all of you have assembled here, I can't say nothing at all. So I'll give you all an expedient that was offered by one of the ancients. Take care." He then left the Dharma seat. You can hear, see these monks turning to one another. This is the same Fayen who, in a koan in the Muangkan, directed the monks to roll up bamboo blinds, which they did, and then he said, "One has it, the other does not." Why would that be a koan? If he's just saying, "Okay, one has realized his true nature, the other one hasn't." Well, more deeply. He knows that both are equally endowed with this Buddha mind. A monk asked him, "What was the style of the ancient Buddhas?" Fayen said, "Where can it not be completely seen?" Here's another koan. This is also in the Shoryuroku. Fayen asked a monk, "Did you come by boat or by land?" The monk replied, "By boat." Fayen said, "Where is the boat?" The monk said, "The boat is in the river." Then after the monk had left, Fayen turned to another monk standing to one side and asked, "Did that monk who was just here have the eye or not?" A monk asked, "What is the ultimate teaching of all Buddhas?" Phaian said, "You have it too." A monk asked, "What is the first principle?" Phaian said, "When I speak to you, that is the second principle." There's a story that in former times a Zen monk lived alone in a cottage. Above his door he wrote the word "mind." Above his window he wrote the word "mind." And on his wall, he wrote the word "mind." Phaian said, "Above his door, he should have written door. Above his window, he should have written window. And on his wall, he should have written the word wall." Words are just the finger pointing at the moon. He had 63 Dharma heirs, and although the influence of his school was widespread, the lineage died out after five generations. All right. Now that we're loaded up on biographical material about these two, let's turn back to this short koan. Dizong asked Phaian. So here Phaian was still not a master, had still not realized his true nature. He asked him, "Where are you going?" Phaian said, "I'm wandering on pilgrimage." Most of you know that the custom in ancient China was that the monks would alternate three-month periods in the monastery and then off traveling around visiting other monasteries. Here he was doing the latter. "I'm wandering on pilgrimage." Dizong said, "What are you on pilgrimage for?" That's a penetrating question. Just because it's a convention? What are you seeking that you can't find here at our own monastery? What are you seeking that you don't already have? And then no explanation from Phaian, no attempt to justify his pilgrimage. Just, "I don't know." Whew. There it is. It's a key point of the koan to really appreciate his state of mind when he says this, "I don't know." In fact, with many of the koans, we are called upon to see through the words into the state of mind of the person who has uttered them. How were they said? With what understanding or lack of understanding? It's a great training, these koans, in dealing with people in our everyday lives. because people can use words in every kind of way, but what's behind the words? It's great in evaluating candidates for political office who are geniuses at obfuscating with words, using them in every kind of way to avoid really answering the question, trying to avoid displeasing any contingent, any political contingent. Probably the most famous response in Zen from Bodhidharma's reply to the Emperor Wu. Is the last thing that a politician would say if they're asked a question. This is one of the things that impressed me about the architects we hired to build this retreat center was when it was down to two firms, architectural firms, left in the search. And in the interview, I said to John Barrow, whose firm bears his name still, Barrow Architecture, I asked him a question. I don't remember what it was. And he looked right at me and said, "I don't know." Now, that's someone I want to work with. Someone with the security, the integrity to say, "I don't know," when he doesn't know. We were already leaning toward him, but for me, that clinched it. And then, after Fayan's "I don't know," Dizong said, "Not knowing is the most intimate." And that Fayan was suddenly enlightened. How so intimate? Another translation is, not knowing is the nearest. Same Chinese character translated in different ways. Nearest, most intimate. This is the whole purpose of a koan or a practice involving inquiry, is to scour the mind, to empty the mind, to reach this point of pregnancy, really. This is the darkness, the womb of our true nature, this realm that is without a single thought marring it, this darkness of not knowing, which gives birth to all things. Xuanzi, the Taoist, great Taoist sage, said, "Where darkness is at its darkest, there is the gateway to all liberation." that's used in a different sense in conventional circles, where you might, as an encouragement, say the light is always darkest right before the dawn. But that's a different thing. That's when you've reached your lowest point of discouragement, whatever. Right there, you have the possibility of changing the whole thing. And that's fair enough as far as it goes. What that darkness suggests is you've reached your limit. You've reached your limit. You've exhausted your resources. And in that sense, it's the same as this other, I don't know. Either way, we've created a receptive realm where new insights can emerge. So many of these stories of awakenings are just that, or even not even in Buddhism. I read about this exchange between Dizang and his teacher Xuanzha about the chair, the bamboo, and the wood, and the final thing that we're told brought Dizang to awakening was when Xuanzha said, "I've searched across the great earth for a person who understands the Buddha Dharma, but I haven't found one." And here, reading from the Shoryu Roku, that same anecdote is, he says, this is almost the same, but it's a Linchi. I'll just read it. Linchi asked Dizang, "Where do you come from?" Dizang said, "From Luan City." Linchi said, "There is something I would ask about. May I?" Dizang said, "I don't understand." Linchi said, "Even searching throughout the whole of China, it's hard to find one who doesn't understand." We are so desperate to grasp at explanations, at words, generally, concepts, anything to fill the void. That's our addiction to thoughts. It takes so much work to bring the mind to this state of purity, of darkness. We're not leaning against words and phrases, concepts, knowledge. Hakuin said, "The mirror of wisdom is dark, dark as the mouth of a wolf." Rainer Maria Rilke, who presumably knew nothing of Buddhism, but whose writings suggest that he had some real understanding of reality, referring to this darkness that we see Fa Yen in, where he says, "I don't know." And Dizang, not knowing is the most intimate, Rilke said, "You darkness from whom I am born, I love you more." If only we could love that darkness of no thought. That's where every practice is introducing us to, and through which we become more and more intimate with, is that darkness of not knowing. And over time, we do come to appreciate it, if not love it, but ultimately love it. That is our birth, our birthplace. Most people hate saying, "I don't know." But there's the other problem, too, where people who ought to know, as part of their job, where they too often may flee into this, what they think of as the Zen response, "I don't know." And at those times, you have to ask, why don't you know? This is your job. You should know this. But the hard thing is to not be flailing away at explanations just in defense of yourself. There's this story of a businessman who was driving from New York to Chicago, and he just decided that he wanted to get off on the back roads, that to enjoy the scenery more. And before long, he found himself lost, hopelessly lost, confused, turned around. So he parked his car on the shoulder of the road when he saw a farmer in the field, and he trudged across the field in his nice shoes and slacks. And he reached the farmer, and he said, "Hey, can you tell me how much farther is it to Chicago?" And the farmer said, "Well, I don't rightly know." He said, "Okay, well, tell me this. How far is it from New York, where I just came from?" The farmer said, "Well, I don't rightly know." And then now the businessman is getting exasperated with the farmer, and he said, "Well, at least can you tell me how I get back on the main road?" The farmer said, "I don't rightly know." And the businessman, "Well," said, "you don't know much of anything, do you?" The farmer said, "Yep, but I'm not lost." To not know is not to be lost. To truly not know is to be on the verge of finding oneself. Time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha, I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind matchings. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.